This is WKAR's Current State. We have a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist visiting us here in mid-Michigan at the Wharton Center, Isabel Wilkerson. And Melissa Benmark, you caught up with her recently, and what's going on?
Her book, The Warmth of Other Suns, in a joint appearance with television journalist Soledad O'Brien. And Wilkerson's book is just this amazing epic work of nonfiction that chronicles the great migration northward of Southern African Americans after the Civil War in three different waves. I talked to her last week and started out by asking Wilkerson why she took on such an enormous topic.
Well, I happen to be a product of the Great Migration, of which I've written. And I had the chance to observe, once I grew up, the evidence of the Great Migration when I was a reporter for the Detroit Free Press, I should say, and then also for the New York Times, where I spent most of my career. And the work required that I travel throughout the Midwest and often out to the West Coast to talk with people based upon whatever the story might have been. And whenever I was speaking with people who were African American, and if you talk with them long enough, you would hear stories about someone returning back home or someone having been raised or their parents were raised back in the South. And so, in other words, the story of the migration bubbles forth whenever you speak to someone who's raised in the North, the Midwest, and West, because this is where people had come from.
How did you find over 1,000 people to talk about their migration experiences?
I went to the places where these people would have been spending time, given that they were up in years by the time that I met them. So the goal was to find people who were part of this great migration of 6 million African Americans from the South to the Midwest and the West. And that meant that they were now up in years, senior citizens, and they would go to senior centers during the day. I would find them in churches. There were actually, in the states that the people migrated to, there were actually state clubs that represented the places that they were from, so that if you were in Chicago, for example, there were actually multiple Mississippi clubs. There's a Greenwood, Mississippi club, a Greenville, Mississippi club, a Newton, Mississippi club, so
wow.
Many different clubs that represented where the people were from. And so that wherever you went, wherever I went, there were representations of the origins of the people that I was speaking to.
I didn't realize that you had worked in Detroit. And one of the things about this book that I found really fascinating was that as a person from Michigan, and Detroit is our biggest city, I really had no clue at all. I mean, did you find that there was a kind of a lack of understanding of how so much of Detroit's population got there while you were here?
I find that fascinating, don't you?
It is. It's like there are two big questions in my head. I've lived here my whole life in Lansing area. How did the African Americans get to Detroit, and how did Detroit get the largest Arab American population outside of the East Coast? Those are always the two questions that I don't know.
Absolutely. And so this is an attempt to answer the first of those two questions. And I am a product of this great, very migration that I've written about. And I, too, took it for granted, didn't truly really understand my parents. Well, first of all, I should say that this migration unfolded in three distinct streams. So there was the East Coast stream, which carried people from Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia to Washington, D.C., and to Philadelphia, New York, and on up the East Coast. There was a Midwest stream, which carried people from Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Tennessee to the Midwest, meaning Michigan, to Illinois, to Ohio, Minnesota, the entire Midwest. And then there was the West Coast stream, which carried people from Louisiana and Texas out to California. And so that means that to this day, when you meet an African American in a particular city in the North, and if they were born and raised there, very likely they will have roots or origins in the states that I mentioned. In other words, in Michigan, there are many, many people whose families are actually from Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Tennessee. That was the beautifully predictable stream in which fed Michigan during the Great Migration. The question you asked about how and why they got there is the whole reason that I decided to spend 15 years on this topic. I really wanted to understand what were the forces that led people to make these decisions. this was one of the greatest, the biggest internal migration in the country's history, and it started during World War One and didn't end until the 1970s. And so one of the things that propelled it, there were many, many things, but one of them is that they were, in some respects, they were fleeing a caste system. They were defecting a caste system that was so extreme that it was actually against the law for a black person and a white person to merely play checkers together in Birmingham.
That blew my mind. I couldn't. How did you even find that detail?
Well, I set about to really try to make it come alive and not to focus in on the things that we know already. You know, the water fountains and the restrooms that we see depicted. I wanted to be able to describe it so that people can imagine what was it really like to live in that kind of repressive regime, which is what, you know, which is what Jim Crow was for much of the 20th century, to really understand the, you know, why there was this desire to defect from the world that they were in. It was a very, it was not only repressive and arcane, you know, ways of the things, the little things that you couldn't do. The fact that there were staircases in places of employment, there's a segregated staircase. So if you were black, you went up one staircase. If you're white, you went up another staircase. Elevators were segregated. The telephone booths were segregated, so that there were so many restrictions and limitations. But on top of that, there was a huge amount of violence that was used to control and maintain this caste system, so that it was so severe that every 4 days an African American was lynched for some perceived breach of the caste system I'm describing. And so this set about, this was the world that they were living in, and the migration began when during World War One the North had a labor shortage because the immigrants from Europe who had been working the factories and the steel mills of the North, they were no longer coming in large numbers as they were before World War One. I mean, World War One, you know, ceased immigration, and so the North began looking for the cheapest labor it could find, and it began to recruit African Americans to the North. And that meant that for the first time in large numbers, African Americans began to migrate out of the South in a wave that would not end until the 1970s, when the caste system ultimately came to an end with the civil rights legislation of the 1960s. But one of the things that I hear most often when I talk about what, when people have read the book, is they say just what you said. They say, I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea that this was going on in my lifetime. Remember, this is going into the 1970s, which is within the lifespan of, you know, many, many, many adults alive today. So this is not ancient history, living history.
Your title, The Warmth of Other Suns, the first thing, of course, being from Michigan, that I thought of is how brutal our winters must have seemed to people born in the South. But as you were talking to people, was there one universal thing that came up as the thing they most missed about the South? Or was it a real variety of experiences? What was hardest?
That's a great question. I think that when you're speaking of 6 million people, then there would be 6 million answers to that question. And I tapped into, you know, about 1,000 or so of the answers to that. I would say that, you know, they missed many, many things. I mean, for some of them, they missed certain aspects of the food. There's a funny story in the book about someone going to great lengths to bring some sweet potatoes on the train with them when they were going north, and that the sweet potatoes, the trunk that was holding all the sweet potatoes broke loose, and they, you know, flung all throughout the train, and the efforts to try to get them, the people to retrieve those sweet potatoes before they all were picked up by other passengers.
They disappeared mysteriously by other people who missed them too.
Exactly. And so there was something about the recognizable reminders of home that they tried to bring with them. I think that on the whole, though, they missed the people, of course. They missed the parents that they'd had to leave, the neighbors that they had grown up with, and they missed the familiar comfort of being around people who know you so well. One of the things that's so similar to any other immigration experience is that when they left, they lost a bit of the identity that goes with being from a place where everyone knows you and people knew your parents and your grandparents and your great-grandparents, and having to remake yourself. I mean, that's very much the immigrant experience of starting over yet again and making something of yourself in a new place, and that's what many of them had to deal with.
One subject that you write about is the perceptions between Northern African Americans who had already been living in the North for a period of time and then the Southern African Americans who migrated from the South, that there were some opinions they held about each other's ways and maybe perhaps which group considered themselves to be better citizens. It kind of sounds like I would be, if I was writing about this and I stepped into that, I mean, were you prepared for that? Did you know of that kind of breakdown between the two groups? Or did you just discover it in the course of writing and go, wow, what did I just uncover here?
I think that when you look at any population, there will be, there will be delineations that people find to distinguish oneself from others. And I think that that's what happened here. It's also representative of the general human response when you have a migration experience, an immigration experience. I mean, we're seeing this now with the response to immigration from Central America to the United States. There may be differences in opinion by those who are here already. It's sort of a natural human reaction. And I make comparisons throughout the book. While this was not an immigration experience because these people were citizens of the United States, there are similarities between the reaction that people had to them, similar to what might happen with people who have immigrated from another country. And that is, in fact, some of them did journey farther than some people journey just to get to this country from outside of the country. In other words, for those who went from the East Coast all the way to California or to Washington State, their migration was as far as some immigration experiences might be. And the reaction to them being newcomers was one of resistance and hostility, which made their adjustment even more difficult.
The three people that you primarily profiled in the book, Ida Mae Brandon Gladney, George Swanson Starling, and Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, it sounds like in many ways that they let you into their lives, and they've all passed on now. In the time since you've written the book, have you found other things that you wish you had asked them or wish you had told them?
I have to say, I spent so much time with them, particularly with Ida Mae Gladney, who lived the longest, and I just treasure the time that I spent with them. I feel really comfortable with what I learned from them and the wisdom that I was able to glean and pass on through. They used me, you might say, as a way to share their story with the world, and I'm really happy with the response that it's gotten. And I don't look back with regret. I'm just grateful that I had the chance to meet them. And I hear from people all the time who say, in fact, they often speak of them as if they knew them. Readers will say, that Ida Mae is the most amazing person I've ever known. And I think that's just lovely.
You're a multiple award-winning journalist, including the Pulitzer. But the transition from writing for newspapers with a quick turnaround time, hours or days, to writing not just a book, but a book that took about 15 years or so to research, how did you deal with the change in the pacing and the scale and the scope?
That's a great question. Actually, as a journalist, I specialized in narrative nonfiction, meaning most of the stories that I wrote were longer form. And so I was accustomed to the pacing and actually welcomed the idea of being able to go deeper with the story. I appreciated being able to do that. When it came to the actual, being out of the, out of circulation, you might say, for so long, I found that I was so busy with all of this. I interviewed over 1,200 people, as a sort of a casting call in order to find the protagonists, the three protagonists that I would ultimately settle on for the book. I, did multiple interviews with people in all of their lives. I was so very busy. I was constantly working. I didn't feel as if I was, out of the loop. I felt as if I was very much in the thick of things with the story I was telling. And I was always learning things. I think when you read the book, you get a sense of you're learning so many things. You learn, for example, the origins of Delta Airlines. Who knew that they were based in Monroe, Louisiana, where one of the characters was from?
Right.
And so I was learning so much. I was constantly being astonished by how much I didn't know, and I found it to be really fulfilling.
The thing that struck me about this book is, to be perfectly honest, I'm usually not that big of a historical nonfiction person. I tend to kind of gravitate toward fiction. But the way you wrote about your subjects was so compelling and so you can't not care what happens. Do you have any particular influences in terms of a fiction author? Or it just really struck me how I couldn't believe that every bit of the book was true, and yet I believed in it the way I believe in a well-written novel. You know what I mean?
Well, thank you for that compliment. One of the influences was The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. I really studied the structure of that book. That book gave me insight into how to balance the deeply personal, intimate stories of these three people, along with the larger story of the migration itself. And so I was hugely influenced by the structure of his book, but also by the idea of his book. His book was about the migration, the Dust Bowl migration from Oklahoma to California around the time that during one of the decades that encompassed the Great Migration. So that was a smaller migration, and yet he was able to bring it to life through the story of the Jode family, and I found that incredibly inspiring. And I felt that there was a tremendous responsibility to telling this story and bringing the reader in, so that the reader could be on the train with the people in this book, in the same way you were, you know, in the truck with the Jodes. If I could pull it off, I knew that in some way it would help people to see what it was like to be these people, as opposed to reading statistics about it. And so I found that really hugely inspiring.
This has been out since 2010. How have readers reacted to the book?
Well, I have just been astonished. As you know, the book is the book involves three different people over the course of many decades. And it is a work of history, but it's written with the idea of pulling people in so that they can see themselves in the stories of these people. And the response has been so astonishing that I'm still on the road talking about it 4 years later. I just actually returned from the UK, where I was speaking about it at Parliament, believe it or not.
Really?
And at the invitation of one of the MPs there, Diane Abbott, and she held an event in which I was able to speak about the book. Earlier in the year, I was in Singapore talking at several universities there about the book. I've been to the Netherlands talking about the book. I've been to Italy talking about the book. I've been to Alaska in January talking about this book. And so it has really
wow,
taken on a life of its own, as people find that they identify with the challenges and the strength of these people as they're, you know, pushing their way to make a better life for themselves, in the same way that for many, many, many Americans, there were ancestors who did a similar thing along a different trajectory, a different migration stream, whether the stream from Europe to across the Atlantic to parts of the United States, or whether from across the Pacific Ocean or across the Rio Grande. It's very, very human to want something better than where you happen to be, if where you happen to be is not allowing you to flourish as you know in your heart that you can. And so it's really sort of the pursuit of the American dream that they were seeking, and yet this is a different way of looking at it. And this migration has really affected every American in ways that we may not realize. And the music that we listen to is, in some ways, an outgrowth of the Great Migration. Much of what we listen to would not even exist had there been no Great Migration. The genre of jazz itself is a creation of the Great Migration. John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk and Miles Davis all were products of the Great Migration, whose talent might not have come to the fore had they or their parents not made the great leap of faith to migrate out of a place that was not nourishing and where their talents would have gone unnoticed and untapped. Everywhere I go, I've mentioned those places: Singapore, the Netherlands, Italy, the UK, Alaska, wherever it may be, there's not a place that I go where I don't mention Michigan. That's because Motown would not have existed had there been no great migration. Berry Gordy, his parents were from Georgia. They migrated to Detroit, where he was born. And when he got to be a grown man, he decided to pursue music. And he, you know, needed to find talent for this new business that he was creating. And he didn't have to go far. He looked around himself, and there he was surrounded by children whose parents had come up in the Great Migration. And the people he discovered, you know, the vast majority of those people, from Diana Ross to the Jackson 5, Smokey Robinson, all of those people were products of the Great Migration, many of whom would not even have existed had there been no Great Migration, because their parents wouldn't have met.
Right.
Diana Ross's father was from West Virginia. Her mother was from Alabama. They both came to Detroit during different years, met, married, and you know, the rest is history. And so much of what we know as American popular culture, from the music that we listen to theater, such things as A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry, the works of August Wilson, you know, The Piano Lesson, and all of his other plays, are all in some ways products of the Great Migration, because they wouldn't have existed without it. And their works were in some ways an homage to the Great Migration, about the what was lost and what was gained, and the struggles of the people who were trying to make a way for themselves, and often in alien space. And so that's what, you know, that's what has become in some ways part of 20th century culture, but it actually is a culture that grew out of the Great Migration. Such people as Toni Morrison, we wouldn't likely know her name had her parents not migrated out of Alabama to Ohio. And it just goes on and on and on, from Jesse Owens to Bill Russell, and on and on to Bill Cosby. All of these people are descended from the Great Migration.
Wow, that's quite a list, and more in the book, too.
Yes.
So given the epic nature of the book, it's kind of hard to believe that that was your first book. It was very successful. It took a long time. You interviewed a lot of people. Do you think about writing another book? And if you do, do you see yourself doing something on that scale, or something maybe a little bit shorter? Or what? I mean, it's hard for me to imagine doing something like this twice in a lifetime, let alone once.
Well, I'm still, you know, still mulling over that. I am working on several things, but this book has continued to draw me in. I mean, I'm so thrilled to be coming there and speaking about this at Michigan State. I'm just thrilled to be able to come, and I sort of am taking my cues from both readers and from the book itself. It seems as if it's not finished with me. I just think that I think the goal that I had for this book is to show that we all have so much more in common than we've been led to believe. I think that, you know, one of the great tragedies of the 20th century is that when these people came up during the Great Migration from such places as Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia to the north, and arrived in these big cities and met with such resistance, the restrictive covenants and the redlining and the restrictions from not being able to join some unions, and the really hardships that they faced. And then they, you know, at the same time that they were arriving in the cities, there were people coming from other parts of the world. And they, too, were getting caught up in what became sort of a northern caste system and pitted one group against the other. And it saddens me to this day, looking back at the history and seeing how it unfolded, at how tragic the misunderstandings and the miscues happened to have been. That these people, all arriving, some from Eastern and Southern Europe and some from other parts of the world, and then those coming up from the South into the big cities, all were the same people. You know, they were all coming from, you know, rural places, hamlets, you know, where they were had left all that they knew and were arriving in these new places and forbidding, difficult places far from home, and trying to make a way for themselves and their family. And I wish so much that people could see how much we all have in common, and see that everyone really truly wants the same thing, and if we could somehow push back these artificial barriers that have been created that divide us.
Well, Isabel Wilkerson, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.